Good afternoon. Today is March 28, 2017. Welcome to the Subcommittee on Public Safety. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5033. If Mr. Bender will please introduce it, and while he's introducing it, Chief Justice Ballmer and Per Ramfjord would go ahead and come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Subcommittee members. Today starts the first of 3 days scheduled of public hearings on the Public Defense Services Commission budget. This commission is charged with providing indigent defense services. Under constitutional and statutory provisions, the agency provides representation to individuals who cannot afford their own attorney in criminal cases and juvenile delinquency cases and a few others that they'll be mentioning as they go into their presentation. Just to put the budget in some perspective here, this is the second largest of the two big judicial branch agencies. The large one is OJD, the court system. The court system comprises about 60% of the costs of the judicial branch. This agency before you today comprises the other 40%. So the costs are a significant proportion of operating the court system. Most of the services are provided on a contract basis, particularly at the trial level, though the agency uses in-house attorneys to provide defense services at the appellate level. There are a number of different models they use at the trial level. In some cases, attorneys are compensated directly on the amount of the case type per case. In other cases, there's hourly compensation for their services. On the juvenile side, there are a couple of models. There's the parent-child representation model, representation program, I'm sorry, which provides some additional level of service in some of the counties. We'll be hearing about that. The one thing I would like to note before wrapping up is that there are some basic differences in this budget from the Judicial Department budget in the following sense. The Judicial Department budget funds an infrastructure that supports the courts and their workload. And as a result, there's some flexibility there as caseloads vary. Certainly increases in caseloads increase the cost of the court system, and reductions reduce the costs. But because that infrastructure is in place, it can absorb some variation in caseloads without a budget impact. The Public Defense Services Commission operates somewhat differently. Because so many of their costs, especially to their contractors, not at the appellate division level, are based directly on caseload or hourly payments to attorneys, it becomes quite sensitive to caseloads. And you'll see that because of some changes in caseloads, particularly increases in unexpected increases in felony cases recently, this has caused issues with the Public Defense Services Commission budget that OJD, who's obviously also handling the increase, has not had a budget impact that's required special attention from that. So as you hear this, these are some things that I think would be helpful to keep in mind as we work through this particular presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark and members of the committee. I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and I'm here to just very briefly introduce the 2017-19 budget of the Public Defense Services Commission. As Mr. Bender mentioned, this is the second big component of the judicial branch, the Oregon Judicial Department, the courts, and then we've got PDSC and the entities and the individual lawyers that they fund is the together are the judicial branch. The PDSC's job, as you know, is to provide legal counsel at the trial and appellate level to eligible persons in criminal and juvenile dependency and delinquency cases and certain other case types. This legal representation that's provided by PDSC and the folks that they contract with and employ is a critical part of our public safety system. And I should say that we in Oregon are very fortunate that the legislature has funded this indigent defense service function at a level that is not seen in some other states. This is a long-standing commitment of the legislature that is really important. It has allowed us to have a first-rate group of lawyers working for people who are criminal defendants but can't afford their own lawyers at the trial and the appellate court level. And we see every day Mr. Lannett, whom you'll hear from, and his staff in the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court. We're very lucky to have this strong system that you have supported and that the PDSC operates. These folks are making really important contributions now to improving outcomes for Oregon children in foster care, and you'll hear about that. Attorneys funded through the PDSC budget represent defendants in the large majority of felony and misdemeanor cases in state court, and it's critical to continue adequate funding for this operation. As I say, we're fortunate to have a really dedicated and talented and innovative group of people who serve on the commission. I don't control PDSC, but I do appoint the members of the commission, and you'll hear from Mr. Ramfjord and perhaps others, and the staff members, including Ms. Kozine, the executive director, and her staff, who both provide the structural support for the operation of PDSC and much of the appellate legal counsel. I hope that this committee can continue to provide PDSC with the resources it needs to help us with the effective functioning of the criminal justice system, to provide balanced representation in the appellate courts and the trial courts, and to continue making improvements in the representation of individuals in juvenile cases. We also need, frankly, to reduce the disparity between attorney salaries that PDSC funds and the executive branch, the district attorney's offices, and the Department of Justice. That has been a longstanding issue. The legislature has taken steps to reduce that disparity, and we hope we can continue to make some progress in that direction. So unless you have specific questions for me, I'd like to introduce Per Ramfjord, who's the chair of the commission right now, and he and the executive director, Nancy Kozine, will begin their presentation.
Any questions for Chief Justice? All right.
Thank you very much.
Chairs and members of the commission, my name is Per Ramfjord. I have the privilege and honor of serving as the chair of the Public Defense Services Commission. As Chief Justice Ballmer said, the commission's mission is to ensure that eligible individuals have timely access to public defense services consistent with Oregon and national standards of justice. In accordance with that mission, the commission oversees public defense services at both the trial and the appellate level in a wide variety of cases, including the full range of criminal cases from misdemeanors through death penalty cases, probation violations and extradition cases that are associated with that, juvenile dependency and delinquency proceedings, and terminations of parental rights, among other things. While the state can be justly proud of the public defense services that it has provided in the past, the challenges associated with maintaining those services is continuing to grow and calls for additional investment, notwithstanding the state's current financial crisis. And I say that for several reasons. For one thing, the overall public defense caseload is growing. In 2016 alone, it grew 1.7% and is up to 173,890 cases, an increase of almost 3,000 cases. The caseloads of individual public defenders are also increasing. Public defenders in Oregon report assigning up to 400 misdemeanor cases per attorney, which is higher than the standards that have been recently established in Missouri and Texas for effective representation, a maximum of 178 and 216 misdemeanor cases, respectively. In addition, while these workloads have continued to increase, the financial situation for public defenders remains a difficult one. The pay gap between the compensation level for deputy district attorneys and public defenders with similar levels of experience remains far too large. Indeed, in the largest counties in the state, you're going to hear the pay disparity is approaching 40% to 50%. The hourly rates also continue to be a significant concern for those attorneys being paid on an hourly rate basis. The current guideline rate for non-capital felony offenses is $46 an hour. That is $2.50 more than court-appointed interpreters get paid in those same cases. And that's not to say that court-appointed interpreters don't do significant and important work, but the level of education demanded, the level of investment involved in becoming a public defender is such that that is a very low rate to try to maintain a lifestyle on. At the same time, the debt load of new attorneys contemplating a career in public defense services is still ballooning. According to the New York Times, the average law graduate's debt in 2012 was $140,000. A recent Wall Street Journal article suggests that that's significantly higher. That's 50% higher than it was in 2006 already. And some of our own lawyers have reported debt loads of up to $240,000. That kind of a debt load, which is really accompanying the vast majority of law students these days, makes it very, very difficult to start a career in this area with the pay levels what they are. So, as I said earlier, these challenges call for additional investment. I don't use that word investment lightly. I use it deliberately because additional spending on public defense services can actually save money in other areas. We've seen those savings in the juvenile dependency side, where the current parent-child representation project is improving the quality of service in Linn and Yamhill counties, and that's led to a decrease in costs. It's led to a decrease of the number of children who are actually in foster care, 134 children fewer in 2016. State of Washington's also seen similar savings in its own parent representation program, which, according to the American Bar Association Center on Children and Law, led to savings of $7.5 million in 2013. And common sense suggests that providing the funding levels necessary to reduce workloads in criminal cases can lead to still additional savings by reducing the time to trial, reducing sentences imposed through more effective advocacy, reducing the number and complexity of appeals through more effective advocacy, and potentially reducing recidivism. Other states, most notably Kentucky, which has been making investments along these lines, have seen exactly these kinds of reductions. On Thursday, you're going to hear from many of the providers who are working to provide quality services in this area against this challenging backdrop. As you listen, I encourage you to bear in mind the challenges that public defense, the importance of public defense services, the challenges that public defense service providers face, and the fundamental need for additional investment consistent with the policy option packages that we have proposed. And if the committee doesn't have any further questions, I just thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to be here, and encourage you to listen carefully to the presentations.
Any questions?
I just have one other thing I just wanted to mention. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. And the Board of Governors wanted to express support for spending on indigent defense. Both the Board of Governors and the House of Delegates of the State Bar have made indigent defense spending a priority for this year. You'll be receiving a letter from the current president of the bar along those lines. And the same considerations that I just outlined are really ones that have been discussed at the bar level, and I'd just like to mention that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Director?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Cozine. I'm the Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services, and we very much appreciate your time today. And over the next few days, we know that you've been through many hearings already in the last many weeks, so I will try and be efficient and succinct, and please do feel free to let me know if you have questions. Otherwise, we will just continue through the presentation. I'll give you an overview of what we'll be covering in the next 3 days. So today we'll talk a little bit about the statutory mandate, the mission, the vision, our values, some history and agency overview. We'll give you a sense of our key performance measures and information about our appellate division. If we have time, we will talk about contract services today. If we don't, then we'll launch into that first thing tomorrow. After talking about our contract services, we will discuss budget drivers, our agency request budget, and potential reduction plans. The third day is dedicated to testimony from invited guests and the public. So, the statutory mandate. The Public Defense Services Commission was created in 2001 through legislation, and the mandate was to establish and maintain a public defense system that ensures the provision of public defense services in the most cost-efficient manner consistent with the Oregon Constitution, the United States Constitution, and Oregon and national standards of justice. So the mission and vision really is an outgrowth of that statutory mandate. The mission is to ensure that eligible individuals have timely access to legal services consistent with Oregon and national standards, And the vision is that the Public Defense Services Commission will maintain a sustainable statewide public defense system that provides quality representation to eligible clients in trial and appellate court proceedings. The word sustainable in there is the one that the commission really deliberated on significantly, because as you'll hear through this presentation, the sustainability of the public defense program is the thing that has continued to worry commission members because of the disparate funding of the prosecution function and the defense function. In terms of values, the commission has embraced cost efficiency, leadership, and accountability. And within accountability, there is a very strong emphasis on excellence in all areas of the agency. As I mentioned, the agency was formed in 2001 as a new independent agency within the judicial branch. So we are still a relatively young agency. The agency grew over time. So in 2001, the PDSC assumed oversight of what was then the State Public Defender Office. And in 2003, they took on additional oversight of what used to be the Indigent Defense Services Division within the Oregon Judicial Department. So in 2003, the commission took over full responsibility for all public defense services from trial all the way through appellate proceedings. The commission members, as noted by Chief Justice Ballmer, are all volunteer members. They are appointed by the Chief Justice, who serves as an ex officio non-voting member. The structure of the commission is actually set forth at ORS 151213. It dictates that members have four-year terms. The vice chair and the chair serve for two-year terms. And then by statute, the commission must include one prosecutor and two public members who are not Oregon State Bar members. Our prosecutor members, we actually have two. Our Chair Ramfjord was a federal prosecutor, and the Honorable Elizabeth Welch was a state prosecutor. Our two public members are John Potter, who was formerly the executive director at the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and then also Janet Stevens, deputy editor of the Bend Bulletin. This commission is an incredibly active and engaged group. They meet 8 to 9 times per year and are truly committed to Oregon's public defense system. Their responsibilities, as mentioned earlier, are set forth in ORS 151216, and you can get lots more information in that chapter of the ORS. The agency has 5 key performance measures. The first two listed here really measure the commission and business functions of the office. So the commission is evaluated based on its ability to meet the best practices for boards and commissions. We review that annually, and I'm happy to say that they are able to meet all of the best practices every year. The second one is our customer service measurement, and that is based on the percent of customers rating their satisfaction with the agency's customer service as good or excellent. Our target is 95%, and we regularly fall within between 90 and 95% on those targets. The other three that I have listed here really are geared to measure the attorney performance, and so with your permission, I'd actually like our business managers to talk about those when we get into the substantive practice areas. So you can see them here, but we will discuss in further detail later. This slide gives you a sense of the organizational structure of our office. You can see that we have 2 separate appropriations for the office functions. The first is the appellate division, which is shaded there in red. That comprises approximately 5.3% of the agency request budget for the 2017-19 biennium. The portion shaded in green is our contract and business services portion. This is the portion that also provides administrative services to the entire agency as well as to the contracting system statewide. That portion is 1.5% of the agency request budget in 2017-19. The remainder of the budget, 93.2%, is what we call the professional services account. It's not reflected here because that's the account that is managed by our contract and business services. It goes out to private providers across the state. In terms of the types of cases that we cover, this is a listing of all the case types that attorneys who are providing services at the trial and appellate level will work on. You can see that the majority are criminal proceedings, everything from misdemeanors to death penalty cases. And close behind that, we have juvenile dependency cases with many other case types in between. So cases not covered by the PDSC. There is a right to counsel, you probably know, in municipal court proceedings. The difference is simply that the municipality is responsible for providing representation in those cases. So the PDSC does not provide representation in municipal court or county court proceedings or justice court proceedings or in violations, administrative hearings, civil cases, the majority of relief from sex offender registration cases, applications or challenges to restraining orders, probate guardianships, or divorce proceedings. In order to receive public defense services, an individual has to be financially qualified. The primary determinant is eligibility for federal food stamps, which is 130% of the federal poverty level. There is an escape clause. If the court finds that an applicant's income is insufficient to hire an attorney without creating substantial hardship in providing basic economic necessities to the person or the person's dependent family, the court can still appoint. The court has court verifiers to help them with this process of determining eligibility. So when someone arrives at court, they have to fill out an application. A court verifier will assist the court by making a recommendation of whether that application fee needs to be paid or waived and whether or not the person should pay a contribution amount. Any contribution amounts that are collected are actually funneled into what we call the ACP, the Application Contribution Program account. That small account earns about $3.5 million per biennium, and it's distributed primarily to support those court verifier functions. So it's built into our budget, but then it's paid out to the Judicial Department for those court verifiers, with a very small portion being kept for work in our office. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Lannett, who will tell you about our appellate division.
Co-Chair Representative Stark, members of the committee. For the record, Ernest Lannett, I'm the Chief Defender for the Criminal Section of the Appellate Division. Thank you for this opportunity to explain a bit about our role in the criminal justice and juvenile dependency systems. As you can see, we're considered the institutional counterpart to the Department of Justice's Appellate Division. We represent individuals in a high volume practice before the Oregon Appellate Courts, and we're asked sometimes to appear for our view as amicus in cases of systematic importance. We work with the appellate courts and other components of the system to identify efficiencies. So what that means really is that one way to think of us is that we are essentially an appellate law office, just like the of similar size to the appellate division of the Department of Justice. We have about 40 attorneys and 12 support staff. As you may know, across the state, district attorneys and assistant district attorneys represent the state primarily in criminal prosecutions and in some matters in juvenile court. But if an appeal is taken, the state is represented by an assistant attorney general from the Department of Justice. In the same way, although there are trial providers all throughout the state who represent criminal defendants and parents before the trial court, we step in and represent those people if there's an appeal taken. We also share with the appellate division of the Department of Justice that we're a small part of a larger system. As noted, we're less than 6% of the budget. But unlike the Department of Justice Appellate Division, that we represent individuals. We have clients. They are financially eligible. They must have a right to a statutory or constitutional right to court-appointed counsel, and they're facing adverse state action. In the criminal appellate section, typically, that's a defendant in a criminal prosecution. They've been convicted of a crime, a misdemeanor or a felony, and they've been sentenced to, for instance, probation, monetary obligations such as fines and restitution, jail sentences, or prison terms. We also do, though, represent an automatic direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, people that have been sentenced to death, and people facing final adverse orders of the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision, as well as people that have been found in contempt of court, and then also if the state takes an appeal in some of these criminal matters, we represent the defendant. With regard to the juvenile appellate section, our clients are parents whose parental rights over their child or children have been subject to Department of Human Services or juvenile court interference or intervention.
That can include taking jurisdiction over the child. Can include removal from the home. Later, as the case progresses, it can change. It can involve an order changing the permanency plan to unification or adoption or a permanent guardianship. It can also end up with a judgment that terminates the parental rights of the person over their child. So, in doing appellate practice, in doing appellate practice, it's useful to explain a bit what that entails. We essentially are auditors of the system. We review the record, which is closed, based on what was presented to the trial court for legal error that puts the validity of the court action in question. Of course, this is of tremendous import to our clients and their families. In the criminal appellate section, that could include that the case should have been dismissed or a person should have been acquitted of a crime, that they received they should receive a new trial, or that they need to be resentenced. In the juvenile appellate section, that could be a determination that there was no basis for state involvement, that DHS has failed to make reasonable efforts to ameliorate the circumstances that warranted jurisdiction, that the permanency plan should have remained unification, or that parental rights should not have been terminated. So these are very significant decisions for our clients, but this all begs the question of why have a central office? And as OPDS and the Department of Justice has concluded, having a centralized office is the right way to approach things. Part of that is the need for experience. Appellate practitioners, the appellate practice and trial practice is probably more dissimilar than it is similar. We rely on a closed record, make written arguments, legal arguments, and are subject to a lot of requirements regarding preservation, scope of review, standard review, harmless error. We don't contest facts, which is a large part of our practice at trial, establishing facts and examining witnesses. So not only is there a totally different skill set involved, there's a high volume of these cases. Our cases amount to about 40% of the Court of Appeals caseload. The Oregon Supreme Court, when it allows review of a case after a Court of Appeals decision and issues an opinion, our cases are about 20% of those cases from the Oregon Supreme Court. The other reason to have a centralized office is really looking at the nature and the role of the appellate courts. Their decisions become precedent for judges, prosecutors, police, and the public. You know, this is necessary for the equal application of state laws, but it also involves revolving disputes where reasonable minds can differ about the meaning or application of a Oregon constitutional provision or a state statute. Of course, there's efficiencies in this, and that avoids relitigation of issues once decided, but there's a corollary, and that is that there really is a need to get it right the first time. In an adversarial system such as ours, it's important that the sides not be unequally matched, because there can be far-reaching consequences if that is the case. The health of our justice system requires action and good advocacy on each part. Typically, in one of these cases, the Department of Justice is defending a government action, and we are taking a position that one of the individual rights or processes that our client is entitled to was not observed, so we're protecting individual rights. If you don't have equal representation on that, you're not gonna be able to instruct the court in a way that it can reach the right decision, whether that be in favor of us or in favor of the state. The other reason to have this office is it is the entity to implement the efficiencies noted up there. We can coordinate and take strategic positions in litigation. We have a statewide view of assessing the issues that are coming up across the state. We're also a resource for the appellate courts, not only as appearing as amicus, so offering arguments in favor of a position when we've been asked to, even though we don't have a client in that case, but we also are involved in meetings, regular meetings with the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals and the Solicitor General to look at processes that are employed system-wide and look for ways that we can bring efficiencies to the system. We're also involved in rules committees like the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure. So these are rules that practitioners and the court use to do the work of the court. We can also be a resource for the trial bar, just as the appellate division for the Department of Justice is. We participate in bar trainings and practitioner trainings for OCDLA, the Association for Defense Practitioners. And we serve as editors and authors and publications of the bar. And we participate with the Department of Justice Appellate Division in giving appellate updates to the trial bar. Finally, we can be a resource for the legislature. We are asked to testify occasionally on the ramifications of pending legislation. We are asked to participate in legislative work groups. And in fact, the legislature created the juvenile appellate section to develop the law in that area in 2007, 2008, because there was a recognized need for this advocacy to bring issues before the appellate courts and have issues decided to be implemented statewide.
Thank you.
So how we approach this this responsibility and our structure is we embrace a team-based collaborative approach. We have two sections, as I've mentioned, the criminal appellate section, and that it's a much larger part of the division. We have six teams of 6 to 7 attorneys of varying experience. They're led by a senior deputy defender, a managing attorney participates as a member, and there's 4 or 5 other deputy defenders with varying levels of experience. We meet weekly to discuss recurring substantive and procedural issues, to vet arguments, and to prepare for oral argument. The juvenile appellate section has a similar structure, although it is one team, but there's the chief defender and 5 deputy defenders and 2 paralegals. And I would note, as it notes at the bottom here, that the team structure is paramount for the juvenile appellate section to work. They have an expedited briefing schedule by statute. Briefs need to be filed within 28 days of the record settling, and that requires them to have a flexibility of dealing with these cases and coordinating their litigation to be effective. Other parts of our structure is that we assign our cases based on the experience of the attorney and the complexity of the case. So we take a deliberate view in looking at case assignment to make sure it goes to the attorney with the right skills and the right experience. We have a tiered editing system, and that's have a tiered editing system. So what that means is that every brief filed in the courts gets edited either by a peer, by a team leader, or by a managing attorney such as myself. And this is to ensure that we're providing the best possible product for the appellate courts to make its decisions. Finally, we also use a team-based approach when the Oregon Supreme Court allows review of a case, and we form a team for each of those cases, and there can be up to 20 a year. The reason that we dedicate all that energy into those cases is because the Oregon Supreme Court is the final word on state law issues. And so the ramifications of those decisions are wide and far-reaching and last, but also because they specifically take cases in to announce widely applicable rules of law. We have a capital punishment team that people participate on a voluntary basis. We usually have 1 to 2 open cases that is a first chair, an attorney leading it, supported by a second attorney, and the team there for additional support. And specialty teams in cases that don't rise as often, such as mandamus and victims' rights appeals. Thanks, Nancy. So some of the ways that we ensure the quality that is paid for, many of those things I've already covered. We view, essential to having the centralized law office is it allows us to deliberately assign cases, have the team structure, have regular meetings, and have this graduated editing system. Also, because this is such a specialized practice, a new attorney in our office will spend the first 6 months working with a managing attorney, either a chief defender or a chief deputy. Afterwards, that attorney will have the support of a team and a senior attorney. We also have a manual of procedure and practice that we developed in 2008, and we've reviewed and revised yearly. It kind of contains all our institutional knowledge about litigating these cases and the procedural steps and hurdles that we face on a regular basis. Finally, we also have manuals for the juvenile appellate section as well as our support staff. Finally, we have engaged in regular performance evaluations of our attorneys. For the first 5 years, an attorney receives an annual evaluation where, and then afterwards, at least every other year. And the content of those evaluations is a written comprehensive assessment of how they are doing substantively by the person that's been editing their work most closely, as well as a measure of their case production, so metrics of how efficient they're getting to their work. And those expectations vary by position, which reflect the case complexity and the case length. Thank you. So turning to our key performance measure, as Nancy said, I would be covering. Ours is the median day to file an opening brief. And to give some context to that number, I can tell you that its most recent measurement was 209 days, and our goal is 180 days. But to really put the context behind this, you need to quickly go through the stages of an appeal. Get a final decision from the trial court. That's basically when the clock starts. So we have a client who's either on supervision or in jail or in prison waiting for an appellate court decision to see whether the conviction was supported by evidence, whether they received a fair trial, or whether they're serving a legal sentence. We have to file a notice of appeal within 30 days. Transcript should be prepared within 45 days, but it is not unusual for the transcriber to seek extensions of several months. And then our median filing date to filing an opening brief is now 209 days. That's 7 months. It's not because preparing and filing an opening brief takes 7 months. It's because our attorneys have a number of cases in their backlog that they have been assigned before that case that they need to work on and file the brief for that. And so this is just the function of where we are. The state similarly has its backlog, and they file their answering brief right now at their target of 210 days. And then it takes about 3 months before the case is submitted to the Court of Appeals, and then we get a decision anywhere from 3 weeks. If they're going to affirm without giving a written explanation, it could take up to months, up to, you know, we've seen a couple years before getting a decision from the Court of Appeals, and that's a product of their backlog. And as you know, they've been addressing that by adding a panel, and so we've been seeing that change a bit. So turning to what, so hopefully that provides some context for these numbers. And in 2006, I think the respective offices were just broken. We are filing our opening brief. The median filing date was 350 days, so almost, you know, oftentimes that would be more than a year after the judgment was entered by the trial court when you take account of the preparation of the transcript. And the state was taking almost 9.5 months to respond, so that's 630 days, almost 2 years, just to get the case brief so it can be submitted to the court. In 2009, we made great gains on that and brought it down to 240 days. And that was through a couple different strategies, such as sending overload cases out to private attorneys, which, of course, did have a fiscal impact. But it was necessary at that point just to jump on top of this and immense backlog. And at that point, the state was taking 210 days, so that, you know, 450 days. And it really remained steady around 230 to 220 until the fiscal year ending in 2016, which we brought that number down to 209. So now we're matching the state and the delay it takes to brief a case, but that still is 419 days before the brief briefing is complete. And, you know, so you can understand why our actual goal, and even if we reach this goal, we would be really considering whether this is the proper time, is 6 months for one of our clients to see the argument that's going to be presented in their case. We were asked to, We were asked to give the committee some information on our caseload. So with the criminal appellate section, you can see here 5 years and also projecting the current year that we're in. And you can see that the case referrals coming in, so that's when a client or a trial attorney or a client's family member contacts us to let us know that they want to appeal a decision of the trial court, that has remained relatively flat, a little downward. I think it's gone down 2% over, or 4% over 5 years. And then the second line beneath is the number of notices of appeal. So that is actually what a case is. So there are many reasons why we might not file a notice of appeal when a case has been referred to us. It might just be too late for us to file a notice. It can also be there are certain limitations on certain cases. For instance, guilty plea cases. In those type of appeals, the only thing that the Court of Appeals will review is the legality of the sentence, not whether the plea was valid or whether the person was guilty. And so in those cases, there's a statutory requirement that we identify an error in the sentence that we must be able to file with the notice of appeal or we don't proceed.
How do those numbers compare to those who are not using public defense?
You know, if I go by published opinions, there is very few reported decisions from the private bar compared to our office. And I think the reason for that is because the disproportionate impact of these criminal prosecutions against people that don't have economic means. In addition to that, even if someone does have some means to litigate at trial, so retain a lawyer and do that then, by the time they're done with the trial and they're serving a jail sentence,
they no longer
have the money. So it is very rare that we would see a case where, and we do, but it's rare that we see a case where someone's been sent to prison yet has the means to retain an attorney, and usually that in most of those cases it's when there's a family member that steps forward to retain that representation.
Thank you.
Let's see. Yeah, I think we can move on unless there's questions about the caseload. As in comparison, and first I must apologize, I mistitled this slide. It is the juvenile appellate section, but it is not case referrals and notices of appeal like the slide for the criminal appellate section. This is actually the notices of appeal filed and then the number of briefs filed by the unit. And the reason for those two different measures, case referrals for juvenile cases are a bit difficult, as are the notices of appeal, because in any particular case, you might have two parents, you might have multiple children. Each of those represents a party. So, you know, our office can be contacted by many different people involved in the case as a referral. Notices of appeal also reflect each of those parties who can appeal can file a notice of appeal. However, our office files notices of appeal only for parents. And when there's two parents, very often there's conflicts which prohibit us from representing both parents. So we file just on the one, and we find outside counsel to assume representation for the other parent. So, but as you can see, the notices of appeal that we have filed has gone up significantly over the last 5 years. And this isn't, this doesn't include projections for this most latest year. We have since gotten the numbers, and it looks like it is at least as high as the last recorded year was. And the briefs filed, I think, are on track for being higher than that, the 121 briefs. And again, this is a team of six attorneys doing these cases. So having the small team, their brief production is definitely much more significantly impacted if one of their members takes leave, for example. So there can be some disproportionate impact on production based on those types of things. Also, the nature of a juvenile dependency case is that it's continuing, so there can be subsequent orders that resolve whatever issues there were that generated the first appeal, so that can be dismissed before it goes to briefing. And when there's multiple notices of appeal, like in the situation where there's multiple children, those cases will then be consolidated, so there is just one brief filed for the parent for all the children that are subject to the order. So that's the information I had on the caseload, and unless there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions?
Just briefly, what's driving the great increase in the juvenile numbers, do you know?
It is very hard to tie that down. I think that there has been, we are seeing that there's increase in the number of filings in the dependency. But I think, I mean, quite honestly, I think a lot of it is because the number of published opinions going back from before our unit was created was definitely under 15, I think, per year or something like that. And now the Court of Appeals is issuing decisions, so deciding matters. I think they're getting upwards of 50 opinions a year, we can get you the exact number. But this creates, legitimacy in the system in that it creates the basis of this is how these laws are supposed to be implemented and followed. So I think it drives, you know, interest and recognition when there has been something that someone can appeal and actually expect a meaningful appellate relief.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee, this was the time that we had planned to take a break for the day, unless you want me to proceed with the base, you know, starting the contract services. It's really up to you. I think we can fit in everything tomorrow, if you would prefer that we
convince end. We have ample time to cover it as scheduled, then we will stop there.
All right. Thank you
Excellent.
So much.
Wow. See, yeah, you guys have to tell Senator Winters we got done early. And on that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Hey, that's good news. So, Steve. Good news. So, Steve.